The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening on this Veterans Day. And all week long, we've been listening. It's the first Friday of the era of Donald Trump, where we sadly report the passing of poet and singer Leonard Cohen at age 82, who seemed to leave a message for all of us on his way out of this world.
I wish there was a treaty we could sign. It's over now, the water and the wine. We were broken then, but now we're borderline. And I wish there was a treaty. I wish there was a treaty between your love and mine.
Those are literally the last words from Leonard Cohen's final album, released just last month, You Want It Darker. The president-elect's first response to the protest came, predictably, in a tweet. It sounded a little Nixonian. Just had a very open and successful presidential election, he tweeted. Now professional protesters, incited by the media, he accused, are protesting. Very unfair. Then later, he tweeted something that walked that accusation against the media back. Love the fact that the small groups of protesters last night have passion for our great country, he said. We will all come together and be proud. We will note reactions of all kinds to the election all hour long, and we invite you to tell us whether you support these protests and the idea of people saying that even though he is legally elected, Donald Trump is not my president. Lots of people are saying that. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Evan, New York, the protesting is important because it shows that if many of the changes and ideas that Trump wants to pass are passed, they will be met with social unrest and resistance.
Later this hour, we will also be picking up our conversation from yesterday with retired Admiral Mike Mullen, former head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. But first, the millions of Americans in uniform must get used to the fact that Donald Trump will soon be their commander-in-chief, something they're all no doubt contemplating on this Veterans Day. We begin this hour with two veterans. Asha Castleberry is a U.S. Army veteran who served in Kuwait, Jordan, and Iraq from 2012 to 2015. She's now a professor at Fordham University. And Daniel Cortez is a 65-year-old Marine Corps veteran who served in Vietnam in 1970. He's now an advocate for minority veterans and has a son who is also in the armed forces. Cortez says he's thrilled with Trump. Asha, not so much.
I'm excited about it because in the Obama administration, a lot of veterans in my community, we were disappointed. We're disappointed in sequestration. You know, when you have a son serving on active duty, you want him to be fully equipped to go to battle, if he goes to battle, to know that he's going to be secure. The Obama administration did not live up to its mandate to take care of readiness and keep America safe. I feel we are more unsafe than we've ever been in my lifetime.
Do you believe that Trump understands this situation?
What's exciting to me is his attitude in general and his out-and-out patriotism and his devotion to our nation. He's a self-made man. You know, my family, we're a family of immigrants. Some of us were undocumented. We got our legality by serving in the armed forces, my uncles, during World War II. I'm proud to say that. I'm very proud to say that. We didn't get a handout. We served America. Trump wants to serve America, and I think he's going to be fair to the Hispanic community by doing it legally, and that's the way we need to do it. And in turn, what he's going to give back to us is his business prowess. And we need to get back to the business of America, and veterans are going to be treated better. Our national defense will be at a razor's edge that it should be. And patriotism is going to be at an all-time high. I think America's best days are in front of us because of Donald Trump. I'm proud I voted for him.
Asha, did you vote for Donald Trump?
No, I did not. And one reason is because I did not come across any of his policies in terms of a comprehensive approach with regards to veterans' issues. We needed to definitely reform the VA. Some of the systems in place in the VA are behind. Moving forward, I do hope that he does a set of policies that will help reform the VA, that will help more vets when it comes to entrepreneurship, educational benefits, more benefits for women. So to be more optimistic, I hope there is a way forward that he does make it a lot better for us. But not all business practices apply in diplomacy and defense. So I will never say that Donald Trump is not a successful businessman. He is. But maintaining a business or managing a business and applying to governing and diplomacy is totally different.
Have you opted out of the political system? In other words, if it's like this next time, will you just not vote?
No, I will always exercise my vote no matter what. A veteran is supposed to make sure that we put the right commander-in-chief in place. That's very important because we have those unique perspectives that we acquired in the battlefield or working in the military overall. It is important for us to make sure we select the right person who is fit to be in the commander-in-chief position.
We did.
Well, so far we hope we did moving forward, but at the time, no, I did not feel that way.
Well, today is a new day and I want to be optimistic about it. And I'm not a Republican. I'm an independent. I vote the person, not the party. But I want to be positive. You know, President Obama is my president. He's been a disappointment, but he is my president. He deserves respect as the president. It's a new day. We have a new president. And we should stand by him and hope for the best.
I totally agree with you, but in terms of the rhetoric that was coming out of Donald Trump's campaign, there wasn't necessary unity that backed up with bringing all Americans together. Sexism, racism, that kind of further polarized and divided Americans. So moving forward, we're hoping that, you know, a President Trump will not continue that rhetoric, but we want to, at the end of the day, just like what you said, move forward with some sort of optimism.
And I guess the question is, you don't really have a choice, Asha.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if Donald Trump wants to order you or your unit to go target families to get hostages out or to take out some target in ISIS, you've got to do that, even if it's against the Geneva Convention.
Absolutely. He's our new commander.
I don't believe he's going to go against the Geneva Convention now. I don't believe that for one minute. He's going to have advisors. You know, people like Asha and I that have served and have seen shots fired in anger that are going to bring him to the reality of what war is. And war is chaos. And in its chaos, there's got to be a sense of order. That we have that through the Geneva Convention, even though countries that go to war with America don't live up to the Geneva Convention. That's why America historically takes the high ground. So to say that Donald Trump is going to violate the Geneva Convention or to suggest it, you know, I don't think that's fair. I believe he's going to be a strong commander-in-chief. And when you demonstrate strength and respect, your adversaries back off. And that's what I want to see in a Trump administration. I'm not an advocate of war. I've seen war. I'm a pacifist. I don't want my son to go to war. And Asha, we can agree to disagree. I respect you tremendously. You are my sister in arms. We have served. America should not be afraid. We should be relieved. I see strength in the White House that's coming.
Would you say that, Asha, you could envision a time, a moment, when something would be coming down from Donald Trump as commander-in-chief and that you could not, in good conscience, carry that out and would therefore have to resign?
Well, I remain optimistic where I'm hoping he would make the right decisions. But you know what they say, the first 100 days when you open up that black book, your mind is totally different. And he'll have his advisors, so he will probably most likely respond to a situation or a crisis or some sort of event totally different versus what he campaigned on for the last 16 months.
What do you think is the scariest place in the world right now for a U.S. military deployment, Daniel?
A shot can be fired in anger anywhere in the world. The Middle East, of course, is a hotbed of danger and has been for a while. For any military man or woman that holds up their right hand and swears against all enemies, foreign and domestic, there are no guarantees. And the military has to be ready to take on all situations. It can occur at home and it can occur abroad. Our threat is in the Middle East. I hope that we counter that threat through strength and negotiation, but America should never again turn the cheek when the other cheek has been slapped repeatedly. I want my homeland protected. I want Asha to be safe and her children and my children and my grandchildren and yours, sir. That's why a strong military is what we need, and a strong defensive attitude, not one of placation.
What about attitudes that Donald Trump has expressed about Latinos in the United States? Are you comfortable with those?
People want what America has. I understand it. My family wanted it. We lived the American dream. We built a business, several. We fought for the nation. We've given blood. Now I'm trying to live a happy retirement and see my children and my grandchildren grow up healthy, peacefully. I understand people want what we want, but America cannot just open its gates and say, everybody come in and Asha and I will pay for you. I want people to earn it the way my family earned it, the way I've earned it, the way my sons earn it. I think that's the American way. Now, we should have compassion. We had compassion to allow my family to serve honorably and prove themselves.
Is there tension within the military about civilian control, about the idea that you have to take orders from someone that's not in the uniformed services?
No, not at all. When you're in uniform, and overall, we come together because we're unified. We represent America.
But absolutely correct.
But as far as not necessarily going by the code of conduct or going beyond a certain barrier, absolutely, they have to be addressed. But we unify because we work as Americans, especially abroad. We come together. We're one team.
What is victory, Asha, in this day and age? And what's the mission of the Pentagon, do you think?
Victory to me is actually achieving peace and security. But there are many challenges that kind of hinder us from actually doing that. It's a tough business. It's very complex, especially abroad where the emerging threats are just out of control. And in the 21st century, they look totally different from how they looked a long time ago. So victory today to me is maintaining international peace and security. But again, it's very, very challenging.
Daniel Cortez served with the Marines in Vietnam in 1970. Asha Castleberry is a U.S. Army veteran who served in Kuwait, Jordan, and Iraq. Asha and Daniel, thanks so much. And I guess happy Veterans Day. Do you say happy Veterans Day?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Happy when we're home.
Yes.
All right. Happy Veterans Day.
And thank you so much for what
thank you
do.
Thank you, Daniel. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Asha. Mm-hmm. Bless you.
Bless you, too.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost.
For those of us living in developed economies, I think it's fair to say that we've had a pretty good 300-year run.
A week ago, right before the election, we heard this from Professor Peter Frankpan, a historian at Oxford University and author of The Silk Roads, A New History of the World.
And that sunshine, the rays, are just a little bit less strong than they used to be, and the shadows grow a little bit longer.
The old world is dying, he says, and the new world struggles to be born. We heard from Frankopan and many others in our special episode last Friday, Shaky Ground, exploring the global turbulence of 2016. We tried to make sense of why this year feels so consequential, maybe even a little more consequential now. From a changing economy to a changing empire, if you're subscribed to our podcasts on iTunes or elsewhere, you'll automatically get this special episode delivered tomorrow morning. Again, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or elsewhere.
to listen back to our episode, Shaky Ground, Exploring the Global Turbulence of 2016. You feel it, right?
Sometimes I find I get to thinking of the past. We swore to each other then our love would surely last.
Admiral Mike Mullen, former head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, spoke to us this week in a wide-ranging discussion about how national security concerns are being matched by the urgency of providing services and care to the millions of young veterans with severe mental and physical injuries from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. On this Veterans Day, Admiral Mullen says even now in retirement, there's nowhere he would rather be than at the bedside of wounded and recovering vets or participating in programs to enrich their post-deployment lives.
My wife and I spent a lot of time in the veterans and family space since I retired, and it's space that has been, I think, very poorly handled over decades. I worry that too often we depict veterans as broken and needing help, and that's just the wrong image of them. They're extraordinary people who've contributed to the country and will continue to, and are contributing to the country even as they've transitioned from the military to their civilian lives. I think we as a country can never forget those Gold Star families who have paid the ultimate price, those who have been wounded, you mentioned them, and make sure that we do everything we possibly can to take care of them and that we continue to reform the VA in a way that it can be sustained over a long period of time. The VA didn't just get the way it is right now in the last 4 or 5 years. It's been decades, and we've got a long way to go to get that right as well. And we need to get that right for those who've done so much for our nation.
Is there anything you are dying to say to a civilian like me who maybe you feel doesn't get what the perspective is of people in uniform about what's needed, about either the security challenges or veterans challenges that you've just sort of outlined, that you wish you could say, hey, pal, you need to understand this?
Well, actually, I mean, you strike a chord with me, John, in this regard. I've been worried for years about the disconnect between the men and women who serve and the rest of our country. We're less than 1% of the population right now. We come from fewer and fewer places. And so the American people don't know us. They know that they've got great respect for us, and they want to, my experience is, they want to do all they can to support us. So having the American people reach out to veterans, to hire veterans, not just for a job, but create career opportunities for them, for their families, their spouses, and that they are going to contribute to the country for a long, long period of time. That divide, that growing disconnect is something I worry about a lot. And I would love to see you and others that are, in your line of work, work to make that connection, work to create that understanding of what a great group of people we have serving America from all over the country, quite frankly, in ways that really are making a difference.
How much nostalgia do you have to be back at the Pentagon?
We grew up, John, in a job, and when you're done with the job, you moved on. I moved on 5 years ago, and I was ready to move on, and I've got a great deal of faith in the leaders who are there now, many of whom work for me. So I have confidence in the leaders, and probably more importantly, I've got confidence in the greatest military force, certainly over the course of my lifetime, those young ones who really make it go every single day, and their families.
Admiral Mike Mullen is the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, John.
If you are the dealer, I'm out of the game. If you are the healer, means I'm broken and lame. If thine is the glory, then mine must be the shame. You want it darker. We kill the flame.
Boy, we received a lot of feedback from you in response to our segment yesterday, which you should check out. We talked with alt-right blogger Paul Ramsey, who claims it was his victory, Donald Trump winning the presidency on Tuesday. It's a perspective we think maybe the mainstream media needs to pay more attention to, but whether we like it or not, it's part of the fabric of our national conversation right now. Here's a reaction.
My name is Sean Kelly. I'm calling from Staten Island. I'm not sure why you let that racist on the air. All you're doing is legitimizing him. And as a Norwegian Irish American who would have been rejected on the front of the gates at Ellis Island around 150 years ago, this guy talking about white identity has no place on the radio. I'm white, and I do not associate with this man whatsoever.
This is John Lochner from Dallas. John, that was absolute genius to have Ramsey Paul on the show. There is nothing that anyone else could have said that people would have believed other than hearing him ourselves. And from everything I could tell about his response to your particular questions, he still doesn't get it. So invite him back anytime. I can't imagine anything moving our country more toward compassion and love than hearing someone like this.
This is Luis Soberon from Austin, Texas. I don't think that he deserves your platform, and I would appreciate it if he and the likes of him was never invited back on the show again, because prior to today, I was an avid fan and listener.
Luis, hang in there. You got to hear the message to understand what's going on in this country. We're going to keep feeding your curiosity and ours. 8778-MY-TAKE is the number.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity with a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, training programs that draw from 50 brain games, and tools to compare scores with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And American Express. American Express has cards and services designed for businesses of all sizes. Learn more at open.com.
All across America, quieter protests are taking place among people who have trouble accepting Donald Trump as their leader, quieter protests than the ones that went on in Portland overnight. It's because of his views on race, religion, and women. I asked Gloria Steinem when she appeared on the program this week if Donald Trump was her president.
No. No, he's not. You know, I'm not going to disobey the law, but I'm not going to pretend he represents me.
Right now, there is a trending hashtag on Twitter, not my president. And meanwhile, the protests around the country have also tested the American tradition of peaceful power transfer. You know, it's a legacy of George Washington, who, to the world's amazement in the 1700s, voluntarily relinquished power and did not run for a third term. Donald Trump, you'll recall, tested himself that George Washington legacy of peaceful power transfer during one of the campaign debates when he said that he would leave us all in suspense if he lost the election, threatening not to concede the result. Of course, he won. How are you feeling about the protests around the country or about people refusing to acknowledge President-elect Trump as their head of state?
This is Daniel calling from Portland, Oregon. And while I support peaceful protest, I don't support the group that is protesting now, which appear to be all millennials. The same group that didn't come out to vote or voted for a third-party candidate, which led Trump to the White House. The millennials woke up in the morning and said, "What? I don't want that," but it's their fault.
My name is Sue, and I'm calling from Sterling, Virginia. In this country, people have the right to peaceful protest. This is the second election in recent history. Bush Gore was the first, where the electoral outcome does not match the popular vote outcome, and people, including me, are fed up with those who claim to have mandates they're basing on completely skewed results.
From Gonzales, Florida, this type of protest is exactly why Trump won the election. Let's empty the swamp, he says, and move on.
This is Dave calling from Newark, New Jersey. I think liberals who are going on this whole not my president thing are really no better than when Rush Limbaugh said in 2009, "I hope he fails." You can't root against the president. We lost. Get over it. It's time to put on our big boy pants and get to work.
Good point there, Dave, from Newark, New Jersey. Newark, New York, it's not useful to deny the facts. We cannot deny the fact that Trump is our president any more than we can deny climate change.
Hi, this is Susan Krieger from Stamford, Connecticut. Although I'm very disappointed and concerned about Trump gaining the presidency, I do not approve of these protests. A basic part of free elections is that your candidate may not win. Before I jump to protesting, I need to hear what Mr. Trump will actually try to do, not what he said during the insane heat of the campaign. If his actions turn out to be as divisive as his rhetoric, I'm all for protesting. But to protest now plays into divisiveness. Not enough Democrats turned out to vote.
This is Tom from Los Gatos, California. I support the protesters, especially students who are out marching. Protest now while it's possible for, you know, Donald Trump becomes president and possibly shuts down all protests, which is, you know, pretty much what right-wing Republican presidents do, just, you know, back to the Vietnam War and beginning of the war in Iraq with George W. Bush and the control of the media.
We got lots of responses from you, and in the coming weeks, we'll witness the formation of the Trump administration and get more reaction from you. While that happens, tell us how you're feeling. Call 877-8-MY-TAKE or comment on the Takeaways Facebook page.
If you want a partner, take my hand. Or if you wanna strike me down in anger, here I stand. I'm your man.
Another segue from Leonard Cohen takes us into movies on Friday with Rafer Guzman, who is film critic for Newsday and also a music critic, longtime music critic, right?
Yes, indeed, and a huge Leonard Cohen fan all my life. I remember seeing him in 1988, back before he became sort of the popular guy that he is now. And yeah, he's also been one of my favorites.
Well, we'll get your favorite Leonard Cohen song and go out on it at the end of this segment, so be thinking of that while we talk movies here. Our first movie is Arrival, which has the strange-looking pictures in the ads and has a great cast, Amy Adams, Jeremy Renner, and Forrest Whitaker.
Are you okay?
You're risking contamination.
They need to see me.
Dr. Bates.
She's walking towards the screen.
That's a proper introduction.
So this is like Close Encounters of the Third Kind meets better special effects?
Yeah, you could say that. The special effects in this movie are phenomenal. That's Amy Adams as a linguistics professor who's been brought in by the Army to make contact with these aliens who have landed. Kind of hard this week not to see everything in political terms. This is a movie about newcomers to our shores, and we're trying to figure out if we're supposed to fear them or if we're supposed to welcome them. Of course, Amy Adams is on the peacenik side. I like this movie. It's by Denis Villeneuve, who did Sicario. Very intense, moody, dramatic. A lot of it's very shivery, works very well. I do think at bottom, it is a lot like Close Encounters. It is a lot like Day the Earth Stood Still. And in some ways, it feels like a very old-fashioned science fiction movie to me.
Whitaker? Good.
Whitaker is good. It's a small role. He plays the Hawk. He's the Army colonel who distrusts the aliens.
Jeremy Renner.
Jeremy Renner, not one of my favorites. I always feel like he's a little sidelined, even when he's not being purposefully sidelined. I think he's okay in this film, but Amy Adams is actually quite good as the linguistics professor.
Oh, that's good. That makes it worth seeing. Almost Christmas, because it's almost Christmas, unless you go into a CVS and see that it is actually Christmas because the decorations are all over the place.
That's right. What happened to Thanksgiving?
Exactly right. This is a dysfunctional family comedy.
This is my potato salad from Poland. Pickled fish, duck sausage with mayonnaise, and to wash it all down, some milk tea with boiled tapioca balls.
Who wants pizza?
Right here.
Wait a minute. Your Aunt May went through a lot of trouble preparing all this.
Yes, I did.
The least we could do is to eat her, what's this? That's it.
A send-up on African-American holiday family traditions.
Well, like you said, the dysfunctional family comedy is pretty much its own genre at this point. It comes with a certain set of rules that this one obeys to the letter. But you do have a pretty good cast. Danny Glover plays the patriarch. That's Monique we heard right there as Aunt May. J.B. Smoove, who I think is really entertaining. You get a few glimmers here and there. You know, to me, this is one of those movies where I see these great, great actors that show up all the time, and I always wonder, why are these actors only in all-black movies. Why don't we see them in other movies? I feel like they've been relegated to this little small subgenre. And I wish I could see people like Gabrielle Union more in the movies. She doesn't really get a chance to shine here because it's so formulaic, but you know, I do have a feeling this will be a pretty popular film at the box office.
Good movie. Will Mel Gibson make it back to Hollywood with Hacksaw Ridge?
I mean, we shall see. This is a very unusual film from him. Hacksaw Ridge, a true story about a pacifist in World War II, never picks up a gun, and yet he winds up saving 75 people in Okinawa. Remarkable story. The film stays very close to the facts, and it's very well directed by Mel Gibson. You can say what you want
about
him.
He's a good director.
But that guy knows how to do a movie. And, you know, it's your classic anti-war film that also feels like a war film. It's exciting. It's bloody. It's thrilling. The battle scenes are incredible.
Wow.
But it's unusual to see a movie in which the hero, especially from Mel Gibson, never once picks up a gun, never strikes out, does any violence of any kind. That's pretty unusual.
Favorite Leonard Cohen song?
I'm going to say I Can't Forget from I'm Your Man. That's one of my favorite songs of his.
Great. For Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
I got ready for the struggle.
Thinking about peaceful transfers of power this week, could there ever be a coup d'etat in America, an overthrow of the government? It's already happened. Bet you didn't know that. Wilmington, North Carolina was once a model of racial harmony and political cooperation. It was the great success story of so-called fusion politics, which grew up in the aftermath of the Civil War.
It was a very prosperous city. It was the largest city in North Carolina. It had a population in which the blacks outnumbered the whites. Was thriving commerce at the seaport. They had tradesmen and every trade you can think of. Their barbers, almost all of the eating places were owned by blacks. There were blacks who were on the police force, fire department. They were just part of a real community.
That's Dr. Lewin Manley, grandson of Alex Manley, a prosperous African-American newspaper man at the end of the 19th century. Manley's community, Wilmington, was wiped out in the Wilmington race riots of November 1898, which removed the elected officials in the local government and replaced them with white supremacist lawmakers who enforced the Jim Crow doctrine throughout the city and the state. This very violent transition of power is the subject of a new documentary out this week, Wilmington on Fire, by Christopher Everett.
Back in the 1890s, you had a thing not only in Wilmington, but throughout North Carolina. It was called fusion politics. And it was pretty much white populists and black Republicans kind of merging together in this thing called fusion politics. They pretty much figured out that even though, you know, they were different races, they all had the same interests. You know, they wanted their children to be educated. They all wanted decent paying jobs. And it was trying to bring some type of equality and balance, you know, in our country, and especially in Wilmington and throughout North Carolina. And the city government in Wilmington back then was a fusion government as well. So you had people actually in Wilmington that were white supremacists of the Democratic Party at the time who wanted to kind of get that power and control back that they had prior to the fusion movement. So they pretty much conspired an actual coup d'etat, which they did on November 10th, 1898, of violently overtaking the government in Wilmington, North Carolina.
If I was in Wilmington back then, what would I have seen during the massacre itself?
Oh, wow. You would have seen, you know, just based off of some of the research and the stories that have been passed down over the years, you would have saw weeks of bloodshed. You would have saw people riding on horseback, walking down the street with guns. You would also saw a person riding in a wagon with a Gatling gun on the back of it, shooting people or patrolling. Because this event was one of the first times, you know, ever that they actually used the Gatling gun. And that's like a predecessor to the machine gun on actual citizens. It was pretty much just an all-out war that lasted, I would say, about a week.
When you spoke with Larry Rennie Thomas about the fusion movement, was that a viable political coalition?
I think it was working, this experiment, if you want to call it an experiment, of blacks and whites joining together, voting together as a bloc. The blacks, the African-Americans in Wilmington, were on a new vista. They said, well, we were freed from slavery. Now we're freedmen. Now we can be a part of this political process. We can be a part of this economic process. And we can be a part of this social process. I think it was great. You know, it was a good time to be alive
before November 11, 1898. It's not funny, though, is it?
Well, Larry Thomas, he's an author, activist, and radio host. Yeah, fusion politics was very viable. Not only did they end up controlling politics in Wilmington, but throughout the whole state of North Carolina. We had a fusionist governor, Daniel Russell, back then. And the fusion movement was really spreading not only in North Carolina, but a lot of other places wanted to do the same thing. But that's one of the things that the 1898 massacre caused. It pretty much not only did it create Jim Crow segregation, but it also killed and destroyed any type of fusion movement ever. And we never actually had another fusion movement in the United States since then.
The character Kent Chatfield really describes how white supremacy was written down in, yes, in chapter and verse.
It's the Constitution and bylaws of the white government union created in 1897 by the North Carolina Democratic Party. And it's several pages long, and it describes how they're to organize, how they're to report, and how their aim is to install white supremacy government in North Carolina.
Where is all that today? Did that get repealed? Is that stuff still on the books?
Oh, yeah, because we actually show it in the film. Like, a lot of this documentation and the people who actually conspired and did the actual massacre, they, a lot of them were lawyers. When you look at the history, the actual North Carolina Bar Association was created, I think, in 1899. And a lot of the actual founding board members were participants in the actual 1898 massacre. You see, this is how they actually solidified it and kept everything intact, and no one ever came after them because they used the court systems to kind of solidify this coup and also keep everything in place, you know, over 100 years later.
Before 1898, Wilmington was a black mecca, as you describe it in the film. How has it changed because of 1898, and how can you see that today?
Oh, you can see the you can definitely see the changes, because back then, Wilmington was slightly majority African-American. Nowadays, I think the percentage is about 70-75% white, 19% black. You see a lot of the disparities, economic disparities, a lot. But it just didn't hurt the black community in Wilmington. It actually hurt the city as a whole, because back then, Wilmington was North Carolina's largest city in general. You know, it wasn't Charlotte, it wasn't Raleigh. But the 1898 massacre actually just stunted the whole growth of the city. So there's no telling what the actual city of Wilmington would be today if the massacre never happened. So it not only affected the African-American community here, but it just affected the community as a whole in general.
And what about the echoes and ghosts of white supremacy today and the talk about those movements and impulses in American life through the campaign?
You know, I think a lot of people don't really understand it, but I think, you know, white supremacy is an actual system that was constructed, and we can see it. You know, slavery and Jim Crow, that's what that was. It was a system that was created to keep a certain group of people in a certain place, you know, and that we've never really addressed it or corrected it. So we still, as a country, we've came a long way, but we still have a long way to go, and we must address, you know, racism and white supremacy.
Christopher Everett, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Christopher Everett is the director of Wilmington on Fire, which is in theaters this week.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity brain training with games to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. From scientists and game designers exploring new ways to research human cognition. Learn more at lumosity.com. And American Express. American Express has cards and services designed for businesses of all sizes. Learn more at open.com.
I used to think I was some kind of gypsy boy before I let you take me home.
As we've noted all hour, songwriter Leonard Cohen has died. He was 82 years old. His voice and songs grew out of the 1960s, a period of spiritual and political turmoil, much like our own time. It seems almost fitting Cohen's passing puts the cap on a week filled with so much unsettling turmoil. Cohen was born in Canada, but he was part of the folk scene in New York City in the early days of artists like Judy Collins, Bob Dylan, and Peter, Paul, and Mary. Although he actively toured until 2013 when he gave his final concert in Auckland, New Zealand, Cohen long ago shunned the spotlight, and his reputation for physical frailty and emotional sensitivity makes him seem almost too fragile for these times of blunt language and political anger. He started out as a poet and novelist, gave those up to become a struggling songwriter whose legacy includes classic songs, Hallelujah, Sisters of Mercy, and Suzanne.
Suzanne takes you down to her place near the river.
That song, Suzanne, contains a lyric curiously evocative of our times. Speaking of Jesus, he says, when he knew for certain only drowning men could see him, he said, all men will be sailors then until the sea shall free them. But he himself was broken long before the sky would open. Forsaken, almost human, he sank beneath your wisdom like a stone. Another legendary folk singer from those old protest days noted this week, this has been such a profoundly difficult period of time with this election, so much vitriol. 78-year-old Peter Yarrow from Peter, Paul, and Mary is still going strong and will play a concert tonight in Monroe, Michigan. Music for Yarrow, he says, is the way to call people to action. And he has a new song that's a long way from Puff the Magic Dragon. Yarrow recently recorded Lift Us Up with his daughter Bethany and her boyfriend, the renowned cellist Rufus Cappadocia.
People resonate with it. And I have known for some time that there are people who are angry, who are uneducated, who are ignorant, who are have been left out, who are angry, and I know that their plight is real, but I had no idea that potentially 50% or close to it of the voting population would be able to bypass the reality that there is a human being here that represents the possibility of really the destruction of all that I have sung about with Paul and Mary for all these years, and that his coming to power, considering the people who surround him who are not of substance, would mean the end of life in America as I know it, and potentially, considering the wages of what is going on in terms of the climate realities and the volatility of the political and military realities in the world, it could signal literally the destruction of our planet.
You know, in many ways, there are a lot of people who have kind of dialed out of the American status quo, the American sort of system for decades. How much of the anger of this is, you know, something familiar? What do you think is going on?
There's a massive wake-up call of people out of this sleep that we are in. I think we see that with Bernie Sanders, people, you know, finally having this courage to stand up, and especially right now what's happening at Standing Rock and this system that we are all trapped in, and this kind of illusion that we're walking through that this is how somehow it has to be is being shattered at Standing Rock. And people are standing up and saying, no, the only way forward is love and unity. And without that, we don't have a world left.
Lift us up. Make our stand. Let love.
Speaking of Standing Rock, President Obama has said that there are other routes being considered for that pipeline that might bypass the issue of sacred ground for the Sioux. Is it an indication of just how much work is going to have to be done on many, many, many fronts over the next 4 years? How do you see the next 4 years?
To a certain extent, people have every 4 years are lied to about what the bill of goods they're being sold is, and we're going to revamp the economy and we're going to do these things. And the truth for me is that it all comes back to finance. And there's been a lack of a real conversation saying that the period of industrialization and the massive expansion of the middle class from the 1930s to the 1970s is over, and it's never happening again. And we're at the very limits of the biosphere. And this form of economic development, if we want to move forward as a species has to be reimagined.
So now I'm thinking of this song, Lift Us Up. That's a pretty high altitude to get up high enough to bypass this lack of leadership, to bring together people who are so angry and have opted out of the system completely, as you've described it, Bethany. What is that altitude, Peter?
Well, you're absolutely right, but that's exactly the altitude at which we were functioning in the civil rights movement, for example. That did not emanate from top down. It certainly was not embraced by corporate world, nor by the judiciary. We lived in a world that was in denial of the remnants of slavery, and we said this lie with liberty and justice for all. But what it is the same kind of spirit that brought people together. As John Lewis says, the civil rights movement without music would have been a bird without wings. So this song, Lift Us Up, is kind of the actualization of that prayer. It says, you know, let love triumph, not the Democrats, not the Republicans, but let the very thing that is the building block of getting through this horror show, let that triumph. And let us have the courage and the determination, and let us have the bravery to not step back. The reality is that the anger is real and must be addressed. These people must be heard and included in society. What Rufus is talking about is this historic, ever-expanding disparity between the haves and the have-nots. And if we care about each other, that's the building block, not necessarily of making it happen as much as it is as having it stick once it does happen. We have to care about each other, folks, or it's not going to work.
Lift us up. Make our stand. Let love triumph.
And on that worried and hopeful note from Peter Yarrow, that is Peter and Bethany Yarrow and Rufus Cappadocia performing Lift Us Up live in our studio. Listen to the complete version on our website, thetakeaway.org. And it's been quite a week. President-elect Donald Trump, we love your reaction to the process, to the transition, to whether you think he's your president or not. Lots of people are saying no. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Comment on our Facebook page. Thanks so much for listening. Have a tranquil, tranquil weekend. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.